this is a recording, man.
Stop.
Good morning, New York and New Jersey, as well as the great world beyond. This is Bob Henley, and this is WBI's Labor and Social Justice Drive Time News Magazine Live. What's going on? It's September 1st, 2025. This is, of course, Labor Day and the fourth anniversary of this program. So much has happened. Wheat Jacobs is in for Michael G. Haskins, our audio engineer. Over the weekend, the Israeli military continued its siege of Gaza City, with the United Nations predicting the offensive could re-displace 1 million civilians. The BBC is reporting that new footage shows Israel bombed the Nasser hospital at least four times, drawing international condemnation for the strikes that killed at least 20 people, including five journalists. Close to 260 journalists have been killed by Israel's military in the 23-month siege that has officially killed over 63,000 Palestinians after the October 7th Hamas terrorist attack that killed 1,200 Israelis, many of whom were attending a music festival. Earlier this year, President Trump shocked the world when he called for the United States to annex the territory to, quote, create a Riviera on the Middle East, on the rubble that has become Gaza, a gross violation of international law. This Labor Day comes as the second Trump administration in its first several months has stripped 1 million federal workers of their collective bargaining rights, the largest effort at union busting in U.S. history. That comes with a massive tax cut and transfer of wealth to the nation's wealthiest families and corporations, and the loss of health care for 15 million Americans. Later today at 2 p.m., as part of the National Workers Over Billionaires Labor Day of Action, thousands of New York City restaurant workers and their supporters will march on Trump Tower from 2 p.m. to 4 p.m. In the A Block, we'll be speaking with Brendan Griffith, the new president of the New York City Central Labor Council that represents 300 unions that represent more than 1 million workers. In the B Block, we'll be speaking with the United Federation of Teachers president, Michael Mulgrew, who just won re-election to lead the union that has close to 200,000 members, including 75,000 New York City public school teachers. We'll also hear from Dr. Everett Kelly, president of the American Federation of Government Employees, that represent over 800,000 federal civil servants that the Trump administration has been trying to actually shut down. We'll get to all of that and perhaps your phone calls at 212-209-2877. But first, let's check in with the Public News Service.
Welcome to 2025 Talks, where we are following our democracy in historic times.
We're going to make Labor Day a day where we stand up and fight.
Jobs with Justices Mackenzie Barris says possibly 1,000 workers against billionaires and allied protests across the country today support constitutional values and oppose authoritarianism.
We are seeing a full-scale attack on our basic democratic right to come together to collectively work for better conditions through labor unions.
Barris says the Trump administration has undermined union rights through mass layoffs and by ending bargaining power for federal employees. The Supreme Court is also declining to review a decision that ruled that states' public sector employees cannot be forced to pay agency fees or dues to a union as a condition of employment. The country's most conservative federal appeals court has ruled that the body regulating union rights is unconstitutional. The Supreme Court previously found the 90-year-old law establishing the NLRB to be constitutional, but the Fifth Circuit just ruled against it in a case brought by billionaire Elon Musk's rocket company, SpaceX. The board itself had been paralyzed by having too few members. Last month, President Donald Trump appointed two, but they need Senate approval. Meanwhile, Trump is painting a rosy picture of the state of labor.
Wages for blue-collar workers are now rising at the fastest rate in 60 years.
The administration attributes the gains to Trump's focus on manufacturing. Critics argue it's the result of the Biden administration's economy spilling over into Trump's term. The number of Americans filing new applications for jobless benefits fell for the week ending August 22nd, but tepid hiring could raise the unemployment rate to 4.3% in August. Analysts say hiring and firing are stagnant amid confusion over Trump's trade policy, and domestic demand has also slowed considerably, attributed in part to tariffs. And it turns out that low-wage workers are falling further behind their bosses.
At a time when many American workers are struggling with high costs for things like groceries and housing, low-wage employers are focused on making their overpaid CEOs even richer.
That's Sarah Anderson with the Institute for Policy Studies. Their research found that CEOs at the largest 100 low-wage corporations listed in the S&P 500 earn more than 600 times that of their lowest-paid workers. Women are leaving the labor force. The Bureau of Labor Statistics shows more than 200,000 women nationwide have left since January, while about 50,000 men entered. Sonia Passi is CEO of Freeform, a nonprofit that helps survivors of domestic violence. She says true equity in the workforce would require equal outcomes on measures like salary, leadership positions, and assets.
We've moved into an era where we talk about gender equity instead of gender equality. It's not enough to just say, let's all be equal. And equity really gets at what it would take for us to get there.
Passi and other advocates say good health care and child care policies could help bring women into the workforce and help them see equal results there. I'm Mary Sherman for Pacifica Network and Public News Service. Find our trust indicators at publicnewsservice.org.
Thanks so much, Mary. It's great to invite back now Brendan Griffith, who leads the New York City Central Labor Council. Brendan, just listening to 3-minute news, you do get a sense that labor faces some major challenges here. All the things that labor has organized around, which is to make sure that households get a fair share of the national wealth, working people, seems to be under assault.
Hi, good morning, Bob. First, I want to just wish everybody, all the listeners and everybody working today, a very happy Labor Day and congratulate you on 4 years of this great show. Listening to the news prior to coming on it's a little jarring. The struggles of workers are more severe now, I think, than they have been. And the risk is even more severe when we see that the attacks that are happening on unions coming from the federal government are increasing. They're not decreasing. And despite whatever talking points are coming out of Washington, D.C., I think what we see is both increased uncertainty. The opportunity to have predictability in your life is becoming less and less possible. And I think also, as was described, where we are seeing gains, what we're seeing are the results of policies that were implemented over the last 4 years, and for that matter, over the last, I would say, 15 or 20 years. Wage gains, in a lot of ways, I think, really took a turn with the Fight for 15 so many years ago, where we started to have a real conversation about what low-wage workers deserve. And we, as a labor movement, went out there and supported that.
I guess one of the things that we gloss over, because we are pro-union, and I, my whole life has been a union member, received wisdom that it's better to be in union. But I think it's important now when we realize that union density for the private sector is around 6%. I think public sector is around 30%. It pans out around 10%. So we have a high level of public support for unions, highest ever. Gallup shows us 68%. Let's bring people along to explain the ABC of this, that in actuality, union households make more money.
Sure. Yeah, no, absolutely. And, the data is clear. If you're in a union and you are doing the same job as somebody that is not a union, you are going to make more money. That is 100% clear. Union members have a better standard of living than those that are not unions. And those that are not unions, we want to make sure that you have every opportunity to join a union, to become part of a union, and to, achieve the gains that union members have fought so hard to achieve as well. The other aspects of this, I think, are also clear and also well documented when it comes to something like, healthcare benefits or retirement security. And additionally, and I think this is, something that we don't want to gloss over. When it comes to safety, unions far exceed the non-union workforce when it comes to workplace safety. Union workers are safer. Union jobs are safer. And I think that's an important aspect of this to highlight as well.
And particularly when we look at construction sites and even during COVID, the odds, we do know, and it's important to say, while it may be slipping the national consciousness, we came through this mass death event of 1.1 million people passing, millions more disabled, and truly tens of thousands of essential workers lost their lives. We know that 3,600 nurses, according to the careful research of The Guardian and Kaiser Health, 3,600 nurses lost their life in that first wave, around 500 from New York, 300 from New Jersey, for things like lacking enough N95 masks, enough staffing. We almost as a nation are afraid to ask. We know 600 members of American Federation of Government Employees lost their life. I remember one of the first stories I did for the chief leader was the young man who his job was to work for Customs and Border Protection. He had a dog that was checking out the bonded area right in Newark. He passed. TSA workers. And we, at this point in time, at that point in time, there was air horns and pans being beaten in the sense of essential workers were keeping life going as we know it. And they were. And yet now we see that the same, we're seeing this attack on those very same essential workers. And I mean, it's even to the point of not just vested civil servants, but we see, for instance, that deliveristas and people that brought us our food, if they have some issue with being undocumented, now are being targeted by masked ICE agents and due process being thrown out the window where they can be taken into custody if they're responding and responsibly showing up for their court date. I mean, this seems like a war on working people.
Yeah, Bob, I you know, both the history and the present that you describe are 100% accurate. And you know, you mentioning the banging of pots and pans, I, you know, for some reason I was thinking about that just the other day. That as, you know, my wife, my daughter, and I were in our small apartment in Queens, every night, every evening, we would be out there along with many, many of our neighbors in this expression of support for a workforce that was doing so much to keep people safe and healthy to the best of their ability under such adverse conditions and risking so much at the same time. And I think that, you know, unfortunately, as a society, we have a short memory. I think there are a lot of people now who are trying to, in that period of such uncertainty and fear, really do a lot of, I think, trying to erase that history, right? Trying to erase the moment when we realized that workers that in the labor movement, we always knew were essential. A broader society understood that as well. And we, as the labor movement, have to push back on that. I have to acknowledge, you know, certainly through COVID, but even today, even with all the work that is happening today with delivery workers, with healthcare workers, with so many others, working people are an integral part of society in New York City, New York State, and in this country, and they deserve to be celebrated. And today's Labor Day, and today is a day where workers get a special acknowledgement, but there's a reality that every day, workers deserve praise for what they do.
Callers, if you are someone that's working today and you want to sneak in a call, are you someone that's retired? Do you have an assessment of the labor movement, an observation? 212-209-2877. We want to hear from you. 212-209-2877. Brendan, one of the things that I remember doing these press conferences and stories about nurses in real time, my colleague Crystal Lewis, the chief leader, writing about NYSA, our New York State Nurses Association, in the midst of the pandemic, saying that the failure to have proper N95 masks and the government changing the guidance, because anyone who knows anything about clinical care knows you're supposed to take the mask off between each clinical encounter and swap it out for a fresh one. They talked about the lack of staffing, and they predicted that they would lose people as occupational deaths in the line of duty, and that we'd have scenes like Elmhurst where infection control failed at the hospital. And working people predicted every step of that event in real time. And yet they're not, you know, and I do see, like, the Biden administration, for instance, with the tragedy that happened in nursing homes, they did come up with a standard, working with healthcare worker unions side by side, coming up with a standard where we can feel comfortable and proud with our older relatives in these facilities because the staffing is in place. And the thing Trump did is now put that off to, like, never going to happen. So what I don't understand is, why is it that after this huge sacrifice, workers were at the table, and now we're being told there even can't be a table?
Yeah, it's tragic. It really is tragic. And I think the example that you highlighted is the perfect example of why in this situation and in so many others, listen to workers. Workers are on the front lines of the services they provide, the products they build, the products they create. They know better than anyone else what the risks are, what the dangers are, what the best way to do it is. And I would just want to also differentiate between what you're describing, which I think is a push for policies that are more focused on finances than on safety, and where I think we did see thinking evolve based on new information. Two very different things. And I think in either case, you listen to workers. But what I want to make sure is that, where we have the opportunities, and you're describing a table that no longer exists, a table should certainly exist where workers have a voice. But the reality is that workers should be at every table, making sure that the workforce is part of any conversation on any industry as it moves forward.
So we do know that the Trump administration and Trump 1.0 did try to target through executive orders federal unions. It was blunted a bit by what happened. Now they've come back, and now that they know where the restrooms are, and they had Project 2025 and Russell Vogt, who really understands the mechanism of the civil service and how to dismantle it. We're seeing a situation where 1 million workers are losing their collective bargaining rights. We saw, I think, Sarah Nelson, who leads the flight attendants, CWA, called this PACO on steroids, referring back to when Reagan had laid off 13,000 striking air traffic controllers, who, by the way, if you take their statement, the air traffic controllers of the time, what they were going out for, reads like the front page of the New York Times in terms of the failure to have proper investment infrastructure, a toxic workplace where you're stressed out. I'm just wondering now, we saw that after Reagan, we were around 20% density in the workforce. It dropped to 10 after what Reagan did by summarily firing them. Are you concerned that this could, as Sarah Nelson says, be PATCO on steroids, and that private employers, we're even seeing in Utah them trying to take away collective bargaining rights for public employees. Are you concerned this sets a precedent for various levels of for red states where there is public union movement to be set back?
I think in any political and economic environment, we have to be concerned about the attacks that are going to continue to be lobbed at working people and at unions. PACO is a good example. And I think you described well the environment that was in, where unions did not necessarily have the public support that they do today. Today we see 70% of people polled say they support unions. I think that the political environment with Ronald Reagan as president was misread because of his previous support for the labor movement. And I think,
he was president of Screen Actors Guild, right? Or something.
Yes. Yes. But he, I think that was a surprise, but that was a misreading of the environment. And while, I absolutely, and the labor movement absolutely is constantly going to be on guard for continuous attacks against working people, in this environment, we do have that public support that didn't exist at the time. Now, to the point that you made earlier about union density, there is certainly a huge gap between the amount of people that are in unions and the amount of people that say they support unions. 70% support, 10% or thereabouts are in when you combine public and private sector. So, it begs the question, where does this gap arise from? And I would say, there's at least two factors, and I'll highlight two. One is that the environment, the political environment, the rules, I think is probably a better way to describe it, are stacked against workers. Even under a Biden administration, to form unions was very, very challenging. The rules are not meant to benefit working people who are trying to find their collective voice and fight for better wages and benefits and working conditions. And I think that's an important part of it. The second piece, I think, is how we shape that 70%. And that 70% saying they support unions is a tremendous thing. It really is a tremendous thing. It's something that we in the labor movement need to acknowledge. And I think we should be proud of, because, unions are fighting the good fight. And I think we are on the right side of history. That being the case, a silent supporter is not unimportant. But what the labor movement needs are unapologetic advocates for working people. We need more and more of those who are going out there and who are willing to engage on the issues and say that workers are not the problem. And we need to find out ways for workers' voices to come together and make sure that we have a sustainable and expanding middle class in this country.
So, Brendan, one of the things that's caught on in the last several years is this so-called gig economy, which is done through apps, whether it be Uber or Lyft. And the idea is they sell it as it's convenience. You can work when you want. But one thing that's lost out of it is there's the social contract of work itself is being diluted significantly, because when you're in that independent contractor, you're a small businessman, an entrepreneur, you're also not getting disability. You're not being able to avail yourself of putting in money into Social Security. Can you talk about like the dangers of larger and larger chunks of the workforce getting caught up in this gig economy?
Sure, absolutely. You know, the gig economy, I think, is just really an extended example of employers and people in power wanting to absolve themselves of any responsibility towards the workforce that gives them wealth, money, and that power that they have. All the things that you describe then are the responsibility of the worker. And when, you know, the worst happens, when, you know, unfortunately, somebody might be hurt at work, they don't have workers' compensation, they might be unemployed, they don't have unemployment insurance, they're looking to retire at some point in life, and they realize that, you know, every dollar they've made, none of it has gone towards Social Security. You know, these are traps for working people. And the argument that you have more flexibility, I mean, you know, I suppose, sure, the parents that can't afford childcare during the day, well, it's great that they have flexibility and they can work at night. But, you know, that it's a Band-Aid on a bullet hole. And what I think most workers want is a job that has predictable hours, that has the opportunity for advancement, that has a modicum of security, both as a person trying to provide for themselves and their family right now, and as someone who in the future might want to retire, and a job that will prevent you from going broke if you get sick. I don't think those are a lot of things to ask, but employers want to make sure that that's not their problem.
So one of the things we did see is that in the last presidential election, President Trump made some inroads in Rust Belt states, kind of building on what he did when he was successful the first time when he ran, and even in some union households. And he seemed to get the jump on the National Democratic Party when it came to discussing affordability, the price of groceries. We've seen, of course, in the first 7 months, groceries are not on the table at all anymore. We're focused on all kinds of craziness. I'm just wondering, but we see now Assemblyman Zohran Mamdani, a progressive, being very successful with numbers we haven't seen in terms of turnout since 1989. And he's running on an affordability agenda. And you guys have endorsed him. Can you talk about the importance of this shift to be able to have the affordability crisis come home to New York, where, as the Assemblyman said in the prior program, 1 in 4 New York City residents are in poverty. We are now, in terms of the state of New York, in according to census data, in the company of Texas and Alabama in terms of this. And when you consider the great wealth here, I mean, this is a very unequal city, but we see working people struggling like never before. Can you talk about this importance of the affordability agenda being a local issue?
You know, I appreciate the question, Bob, and I think the focus on affordability is something that every worker has had in the back of their mind. You know, every payday, or you know, every time that a layoff happens, they're thinking about how they're going to afford their bills. You know, next month, next 6 months, next year. So affordability has always been in working people's minds. What I would say is a little bit of a difference, not only in the focus on affordability, but is in the types of messages that are coming out now. And Zohran Mamdani's campaign certainly is a campaign of hope, and not a campaign of division. And what we've seen in national politics and what we've seen in, you know, previous races is this focus on division. And there's a reality as well that, you know, the workers are, you know, they're feeling vulnerable and they're feeling scared. You know, we have that the cliche that we all hear, right? We're all much closer to being homeless than we are to being a billionaire. And that's true. However, it's not just a cliche. You know, how many workers are living check to check? How many workers are unable to put some money in the bank to save? You know, there's a real threat that you as an individual in your household could go into the wrong direction very, very quickly. And that politics of division, when somebody's afraid, I think really it can resonate. But that's not going to go beyond winning a campaign. That's not how you govern. And the politics of hope, you know, the message of hope that's coming from Zohran Mamdani's campaign, I think, is helping people realize that they have a part to play. They can have ownership of their own future. And then when we work together as a city and as a society, we can move forward in a way that benefits everyone, not just the top 1%.
In my lived experience as a reporter for over 30 years at City Hall, what I've seen when I started was 2,100 homicides a year, Brendan. It's if it approaches 400 now, of course, one is too many. It approaches 400, people are screaming crisis. Of course, closing mental health hospitals hasn't helped in terms of the social disorder we feel in the streets. But when you visit the neighborhoods and cover them, as I have, what I see is where capitalism or predator capitalism burned down places for insurance, immigrants of all different kinds, undocumented, documented, green card, moved into these places and with work, family, and faith restored them bodega by bodega. Artists moved in because, well, they like food from around the world and they don't mind being around diversity. And then it's called a renaissance in the neighborhood. And here's the other part. Then the real estate agents and the oligarchs say, well, that looks like a stabilized neighborhood. Let's buy that block. I've just described to you the history of the city of New York is not. This is secret sauce of people from all over the world with faith, family, and work as their foundation, coming together with creative people to make a more livable city.
I absolutely agree. You know, I am an American and a very proud U.S. citizen because my grandfather, an immigrant from Ireland, came over here seeking better opportunities. When he came over, he was a very proud member of TWU Local 100 that enabled him to have a sustaining career that provided for my mother and her siblings and my grandmother, and also a secure retirement. You know, that's a very American story. An immigrant story is a very American story. And, you know, to the description that you give, I think, you know, I'd like to add just something that I think about frequently, and it was a moment in September, a number of years ago, when this so-called migrant crisis was coming. And I, you know, there were a lot of challenges that the city had. There's definitely no way to dispute that. But I very distinctly remember the first day of school, and I don't remember it because I know Michael Mulgrew is going to be coming on, and he's the expert on education. But what I distinctly remember is walking past a shelter for migrants on 8th Avenue at the end of the day, the end of the school day, you know, whatever time that was, and all of these happy, smiling, laughing children getting off of a bus and running into their arms of their parents. You know, that is, again, a very, very American story of opportunity. And I think that, you know, we don't have the ability to just shut the door behind us when so many generations of immigrants have made this country what it is, made each and every neighborhood exactly what you're describing, you know, a rebirth, a rebuilding. That is a very American story. And I think that we as a country need to look at opportunities to embrace people who are willing to come here, work hard for themselves and their families, contribute to their communities, provide for themselves. That is something that we need to take a good, strong look at and figure out how can we make it so that it's not just the, once again, the politics of fear, but it's the politics of hope.
Yeah, it's really of setting your foundation around abundance and faith. Abundance and faith moving forward. I want to thank you, Brendan Griffith, so much. What are you doing later today? Do you have any activities planned?
I'm going to be helping my daughter get ready for school, and I'm going to help myself get ready for work. And, you know, I'm really just want to mention that, you know, from today until Saturday, we have at the New York City Central Labor Council are going to be preparing for the largest Labor Day parade in this country taking place on Saturday, September 6th. We're very proud to have Rich Morocco of the Hotel Trades Council and Terry Carmichael Jackson of the WNBA Players Association as our co-grand marshals. We're going to have, you know, almost 100,000 workers, 200 unions, all sorts of floats, classic cars, and everything in between, marching up Fifth Avenue, showing that there is power in unity.
And I want to thank Kate Whalen, of course, who helps so much, your communications person. We'll be back. Thanks so much, Brendan. Look forward to having you on again. We'll check in once a quarter, if that's okay.
That would be great. Enjoy it every time. Right. Thanks a lot.
Thanks. Take care. Thanks. Take care. We'll be back with Michael Mulgrew right after this little break. This Work Bites podcast is sponsored by Barish & McGarry, lawyers for the 9/11 community, who remind everyone, responders, downtown office workers, residents, and students, that 9/11 did not end on 9/11. 68 cancers have been linked to the World Trade Center toxins. Everyone is eligible to enroll in the free nationwide World Trade Center Health Program, and if certified with a World Trade Center illness, are eligible for an award from the Victims' Compensation Fund.